Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure the question on your mind, as it is on mine, is how did the world premiere, the world premiere of my new little film, Teddy Bear's Picnic, do in at the USA Film Festival in Dallas? Last Monday night? I'm here to answer that question. It was, as the kids say, it was all good. I just figured out where that expression came from. The NBA is using that as its slogan this year. It's all good. It's all good, except for the part that stinks, except for the New York Knicks. I'll more about that later, but anyway, it was all good. By the way, as I say, I did figure out the derivation of that. That must have come from drug dealers. Hey, man, this is cut with sugar. It's all good. The sound, what's the technical term? The sound sucked. They hadn't cleaned the heads of the projector since Madeleine Albright was in Pigtails.
So people thought like this. You know, it sounded like this. That was all right.
And the things that were supposed to come from the left side of the screen, that sound came from the right side, just to spice things up. And vice versa, of course, to be fair. And they found, I don't know what the name of this new technology is, but it's very, very hip, ladies and gentlemen. It projects an image which, on the right half of the screen, is in focus, and on the left side of the screen, is otherwise, is not. I don't know how they do that. That's not anamorphic. That's Anna Mae Wong or something. I don't know what that is. But anyway, and despite that, you know, you've heard about the Texas audiences. They are great. People laughed in the right places and applauded and everything went fine. So just in answer to your unasked question. But ladies and gentlemen, I'm not in Dallas. I'm in, thank you, say it with me, New Orleans, Louisiana, in the French Quarter. One more time before it becomes unbearable. Hey, have a good summer, man. And it's a lovely, lovely kind of breezy, fresh day here, when usually it would be now already just totally muggy and unbearable, which brings up the point that, you know, there must not be global warming because it's nice here today. Now, you have heard that, right? You've heard people say that. You've heard people talk like that. Well, it was cooler here today, so where's your global warming? Now, ladies and gentlemen, you know me. I'm not a conspiracy buff. I leave that to the fabulous Mr. Art Bell. But if there were going to be a conspiracy, if there were such a thing as a conspiracy in this world, let me propose one to you that would make a little more sense than Martians doing sexual implants on people outside of Elko, Nevada. If you were, and just go with me here for a moment, if you were in the business, even, of manufacturing stuff that made life so much more livable, but an unfortunate and inevitable side effect of it was crapping up the planet, wouldn't it be a desirable goal to have a school system that turned out people so scientifically illiterate that they could say things like, well, it wasn't cold. It was colder here than it was yesterday, so where's your global warming, with a straight face? Wouldn't that be a desirable goal, to just maybe endow the science side of a school system so thoroughly, ineptly, that it could crank out an entire population that was that scientifically illiterate? Now, I'm not saying, you know, hey, the jury's still out on the science, but you know what I mean. To be able to say that is like saying, well, you know, they still score a lot of points at my gym, so why do they need to change the rules in the NBA? Almost like that. Probably worse. So if you're hunting for conspiracies, ladies and gentlemen, stay away from Elko, Nevada, and get plenty of liquids. Hello, welcome to the show.
Oh, babe, there's no substitute for love. Thank you. it has been for women long, it's hard to put them down. I lived in New York City. Some speak in soft language, others let their lips seduce their man. But when they laugh to me, I run as fast as I can. Oh, baby, you know something too far enough.
I love you, baby, let me tell you why, 'cause you sure know how to keep me. that don't make it true. Insinuations can lead to discontent, and you'll wake up some morning and wonder where I went. Instead of sneaking round looking for some food, why don't you ask me and I'll tell you the truth. You don't need a talking pillow, a lamp to shed some light, someone to come forward.
French Quarter in New Orleans, Louisiana, live around the world. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to yet another edition of Le Show. Hi, you doing, everybody? I have no normal greeting, ladies and gentlemen, so I just make them up, and sometimes they just come out impossibly wrong, as did that one. But, you know, show is not about a greeting. This is not about a greeting. It's about a show thing. Ladies and gentlemen, just to clarify, you know that... And once again, we resort to the air quotes here, whenever necessary. President George W. Bush this week launched his campaign for the National Missile Defense Program, the missile shield. You see, it's a shield. But barely had the ink dried on his comments, and of course, there was no ink, when. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld went on Meet the Press this very morning, if you're listening today. Well, of course you're listening today. Whenever you're listening, it's today, isn't it? Unless you've got a more serious problem than I can deal with here in this limited amount of time. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, I say, went on Meet the Press today and said in answer to a question, well, shield is an unfortunate word. So, you know, it's $100 zillion for a non-shield then, for something that won't shield us. No, he just said that, you know, if China built a lot more missiles, which they're gonna, then, you know, this is not going to really do something about that. Because this is designed basically just if one rogue nation, let's say you're Iraq, you're Libya, you're North Korea, just lobs one missile. Now, whatever that strategy would be, ladies and gentlemen, let's tease this out for a moment. Let's not get too Herman Kahn-ish here, but let's just tease this out for a moment. The old strategy, mutual assured destruction, the premise was, no matter how crazy the enemy might be, the enemy is rational enough to make this calculation. Gee, if I attack the United States, my country will be obliterated in response, so maybe I'd better not do that. So there was an assumption of rationality. Now, apparently the new strategy is an assumption of such total irrationality that Saddam Hussein won't be worried about the total obliteration of Iraq if he lobs one missile our way. So we need this shield. Excuse me, that's an unfortunate word. So that would be the strategy, as I understand it to this moment. But, you know, updates hourly, especially from this administration, where they do correct each other constantly. Now the Rupert Murdoch-owned right-wing opinion magazine, the Weekly Standard, is going after them, saying, well, gee, these were supposed to be the adults. They're making a mess because they keep correcting policy. The Defense Department announced it was canceling all military collaboration, contact, if you will, with China. And then later in the same week, it was, no, not really. Not really, really. So that's the grown-ups for you. The president himself, and again, it's the air quote president, broadened his horizons this week, or last week, I guess. You do know that the only country, the only soil George W. Bush set foot on outside the United States until he was elected president was the soil of Mexico, which is kind of a foreign country. You know, any place where you can't drink the water, that's a foreign country. So he'd been there. Now, of course, he has widened his horizons. He's just back from the meeting on the Free Trade Association of the Americas, which was held in Quebec. So he's broadened his outlook, his international outlook, by now having visited Canada, a nation even more like ourselves than Mexico. Just more like ourselves than ourselves. Basically, he went to see where the next anchor men are coming from, are being bred. Because we can't breed, you know. It was one thing when we couldn't manufacture stuff anymore, but we can't even manufacture our own anchor people now. We have to get them from Canada. So George W. Bush, I guess, was going up there to inspect the anchor breeding farm. And this weekend at the White House, you know who's there today? The San Diego Chicken. That's not a derogatory term for the president. That's the real San Diego Chicken. When you have as your president a guy who used to own a baseball team, it follows that the San Diego Chicken will be at the White House. Will he be sleeping in the Lincoln bedroom? I don't know, but some feathers will be ruffled if he does. No, he's there because President Bush, the air quote president, has brought T-ball to the White House. The softball questions weren't enough. He needs T-ball questions. And so they're having a T-ball tournament there today, presided over by the San Diego Chicken. Hey, you know, Spinal Tap's playing Carnegie Hall, so the San Diego Chicken can play the White House. It's okay with me. And regarding the New York Knicks, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not going to say that it's karmic payback that a team that had a guy so dumb that he made anti-Semitic remarks in the New York Times just before the playoffs started. I'm not going to say it's karmic payback that team is wiped out in the first round. But I will say, and I thank the good Lord that the Knicks exist, because without them I'd have to make this comment about a team whose personnel I know personally. But the Knicks, with a payroll of $80 million, well, Miami Heat proved it too. They have a big payroll. They flushed out. But, you know, it's New York. I like to pick on New York. They are the Michael Huffington of pro basketball teams, proving that in basketball, as in politics, you can't just buy it. You know, something else, you have to put something else out there. So thanks to them for proving that once again. Hey, Tarm Arnold, who co-stars with Steven Seagal in a thing, has put his Beverly Hills area home on the market at just under $3.4 million. Arnold, who had lived in the home with his ex-wife, hairstylist Julie Champnella, wants to move on with his life and relocate closer to the city. For those of you who never thought that there was a city in Los Angeles, talk to Tom Arnold. He knows. He wants to move closer to it. His Beverly Hills area home. Now, you know that means it's not in Beverly Hills. It's near Beverly Hills. Near enough that they deliver the mail from the Beverly Hills post office to your house if you buy this. It's in a gated community off Mulholland Drive. It has 5 bedrooms and 6,800 square feet and includes a master suite with a sitting room. Well, you know, you can't expect a Tom Arnold to stand all the time, can you? And 2 walk-in closets. Built in 1990, the home also has a gym, wine cellar, and lagoon-style pool. Better than a pool-style lagoon, I say. Arnold bought the Spanish-style villa at the end of a cul-de-sac in June 1998 from Paula Abdul for about $2.4 million. So he wants to make $1 million profit over in a 3-year time in the house. He and his wife, Julie, moved there from a 20-acre horse ranch near Malibu, which he sold in August 1998. The couple split. He was divorced from him. And singer-actress Helen Reddy has sold her Santa Monica home for slightly more than $1 million, and she plans to buy a home on Norfolk Island in her native Australia, where she will be based for the first time in 35 years. You can take the girl out of Australia, ladies and gentlemen, but then you have to send her back. Reddy has owned her Santa Monica home since 1984. The gated estate includes a 3,700-square-foot main house plus a 2-bedroom, 2-bath guest house, or Gasthaus. The main house has 2 master suites, each with an office and maid's quarters or bonus room. Reddy, best remembered for her hits, I Am Woman. Oh, that's only one hit. I'm sorry. All right, so, see, even here, one can keep in touch with the fact that Tom Arnold has how many sitting rooms? Is he trying to get rid of? Just one. Okay. Where's he going to sit now, you might ask? And well, you might. Ladies and gentlemen, some news in the world of marketing. The good people at Eli Lilly are now defending the company's decision to create something that looks like a new drug, but is actually just repackaged Prozac. It's called Seraphin. And the spokesman for Eli Lilly defended the decision to repackage and charge more, by the way, don't you know? Well, you know, packaging costs a lot. Saying that premenstrual dysphoric dysfunction, the name for what most of us just called, oh, that time of the month, is a unique disorder. The new packaging provides specific information to doctors about the condition. So they had to package it new and charge more so that doctors could read up on it. Is that what she's saying? We asked women and physicians, and they told us they wanted a treatment with its own identity, says Laura Miller. Women do not look at their symptoms as a depression, and PMDD is not depression, but a separate clinical entity. Prozac is one of the more famous pharmaceutical trademarks and is closely associated with depression. It costs almost the same as Prozac, a little more. Prozac loses patent protection, and next year, the Seraphin is patent protected until 2007, till when Fox has to pay the writers the same as other networks, basically. So we asked women and physicians. They told us they wanted a treatment with its own identity. Ladies and gentlemen, that sounds suspiciously to me, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, like a marketing decision, not like a medical decision. But, you know, what do I know? I don't take drugs, and especially not Seraphin. From the digital outlook, I had no idea where that sentence was going to end up, and that's where it did, just plunked to the bottom. But here's digital news. a report by the committee that's running this digital transition. Did a little reception test on the antennas that are needed to receive digital, the wonder world of digital television. Signal strength might have to be increased by as much as 47 decibels to make indoor reception as robust as current outdoor reception. That's for those of us who live indoors. For those of you not used to decibels, that's increasing the power by a factor of 50,000. They would have to increase the power, the signal strength of the transmission of digital television by 50,000 times to make it adequately receivable indoors. So let's convert to digital television and all move outdoors. Well, Santa Monica's waiting for you. There's stories about some small television stations which say they could be killed by the necessity, the cost of converting to digital television. And some stations in small markets are thinking about turning in their digital channels and ultimately going off the air rather than facing the costs of conversion to digital. The president of the National Association of Broadcasters, Eddie Fritz, says the transition to digital TV in this country has been handled about as effectively as California handled the deregulation of energy. I think that's a knock. Anyway, congratulations to the Writers Guild for avoiding a strike. As I say, they have to pay, they got the right to visit the set. And wake me when they get the right to visit the editing room, will you? Will you? But they got a little more money, which is what they always get. And I'm a member, I should say we. And the Fox network will have to pay up residual payments like the regular networks in a couple years, you know. So Rupert Murdoch has a couple more years to buy stuff before he has to pay the writers. So what was avoided, of course, was a barrage of fine reality programming. So today I think we'll just see what it is that would have been in our viewing future had the writers gone on strike.
You've thrilled to Secrets of the World's Magicians.
What actually happened is he crouched inside this panel.
You've been amazed by Secrets of the World's Plastic Surgeons.
She asked me to make her breasts bigger than Jane Mansfield's, and I did.
Now, the most astounding special in the history of Fox, Secrets of the Fox Accountants.
Hello, I'm Michael York. Come with me as we explore a place of ancient rituals and cutting-edge technology. A place where nothing is quite what it seems.
See, we look like a network. People who watch TV think we're a network. But there's this hidden part of the union contracts that allows us to say that we're not a network. And that way, our rerun payments are cut in half. So we crouch in there, and we don't come out.
You'll see how big hit movies never even approach making a profit. You'll see your favorite Fox stars nickel and dimed to death. And we'll see where it all goes as we take a fabulous peek at the Murdochs nobody knows.
If you think it got bloody on When Animals Attack, wait till you see the downsizing at online services. Now, the one special that'll make you glad all over that you work for somebody else. Secrets of the Fox Accountants. Monday night, because everybody Fox.
Close your eyes. More mundane than Miss Marple. More mysterious than Poirot. More fascinating than third reruns of Law and Order. It's a whole new chapter of television's most imitated non-fiction series. And it's bound to make you sit up and say, who? It's Nobody Week on Biography.
Oh, he loved delivering the mail. To him, it was like... it was like a cross between a mission and a job.
You knew it would happen, and it finally has. We've run out of people you've heard of.
What he didn't know was that those halibuts weren't at the fish market every day. Only on Thursdays.
So now, Biography begins to tell the stories of the rest of us.
Bill hated meetings, but more than that, he hated the idea of meetings, the concept of the meeting itself.
For the first time, what you never knew about the people you never knew. It's Nobody Week, all this week on Biography. Because once we put them on TV, everybody's a celebrity. Biography on A&E. Time well done.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, before we get to more reality television, there's another trend that is developing, despite the absence of a strike, and that's the trend of embedded advertising, because we're getting too good. I pointed out last week, the affluent among us are getting unadvertisable too, according to the Brits. Well, the rest of us are doing pretty well at avoiding advertising too, and so the advertising industry is responding by embedding more ads in ways that they hope are inescapable. For example, there's a story this month in the centerpiece section of the Atlantic Monthly on the history of Roget and the thesaurus. On a facing page, I'm informed about this by a listener, David, in Menlo Park. I was reading along when what should appear on a facing page but a full-page ad for Mercedes-Benz with a torn-out page from a thesaurus on the word performance. This was one of the five full-page ads embedded in the story. Yahoo, no, I'm not calling you, I mean, that's the name of the website, is embedding Ford Explorer ads that feature immersive animation that has the, well, first of all, birds slowly flap across the screen when they land and you click on them. Your speakers emit a crunching sound, not like the sound of an Explorer flipping over, and your browser window jitters maniacally, and finally an Explorer drives over the left half of the screen and sits there covering the listings. It's a bit immersive, a bit embedded. And ABC is planning to bring a new reality series on called The Runner, where a guy is being chased across the country, and if he eludes capture by a viewer, he wins $1 million. And so he'll have to stop at various places to get food, like a McDonald's. And so ABC is pitching the show to McDonald's. Like, we'll work your place into the show, much like they did with Survivor, where people were so food-deprived that they went nuts when a basket of Doritos was offered to them. So embedding advertising, it's going pretty far, as a matter of fact. Last November, it started on ABC's daytime show, The View, when Barbara Walters and her pals just happened to bring up Campbell's soup in the middle of discussions with visiting celebrities. And soon after, in November, it spread to an edition of Nightline not previously heard in your area.
This is still another special edition of Nightline. America waits. Is it soup yet? An out-of-town meeting. Here is Ted Koppel.
The Chinese culture has a well-known curse. May you live in interesting times. Historical moments after the first flush of excitement have a way of getting on our nerves after a while. Normalcy never seems as appealing as when it's in short supply. And now the thought occurs that maybe I've done enough to set up tonight's broadcast. The point being, it might be well to take a break. Sit down, enjoy some Campbell's low-fat chicken broth, perhaps, and cast a more reflective eye on the events of the last month. With us tonight are four people who, except for the broth, are prepared to do just that. In our Washington studio is the author and talk show host Larry King. And in Opa-locka, Florida, the former Democratic presidential candidate and activist, the Reverend Jesse Jackson. In West Palm Beach, Florida, where he pretends to do his radio show from New York, is conservative talk show host extraordinaire Rush Limbaugh. And in our Washington studio is the former Republican presidential candidate and spokesperson for superannuated sexual frankness, former Senator Bob Dole. Gentlemen, give us, if you will, your snapshot of the situation we find ourselves in. Larry, kick us off here, if you would.
Ted, if this period we're living through right now was a sandwich at Nathan Al's, the world's best deli in the heart of Beverly Hills, it would be the Robin Williams, half tongue and half turkey.
On rye.
For me, I'd have it on a Kaiser roll, Ted, but if I'm Dick Cheney, and speaking of hearts, I'd be sucking down Melba toast and lean melon like there's no tomorrow, with plenty of garlic.
Ted, if I may...
Mr. Limbaugh, you have the floor.
You ask about the story of this moment. Well, sir, this is the spectacle of the pathology of power, as well as the high watermark of liberal depravity. It's all outlined in my newsletter, which
I'm sure you're very good at selling subscriptions to on your own broadcast.
You want to do a deal? I mean, seriously.
Reverend Jackson, you've been down in Florida holding some rallies.
Some nonviolent rallies, Ted, I should add. None of Tom DeLay's staff members in our rallies.
Oh, the fearsome sight of 10 white men in polo shirts, hush puppies, and dockers, Ted.
Reverend, plant, if you can, your particular flag on this territory.
Ted, we build prisons for the body, and we build prisons for the mind. A vote denied is a promise defied. It's better to teach 10 men to fish than to try to teach a fish.
And, Senator Dole, I know you've thought long and wide on the deeper meaning of our current imbroglio, if indeed you have.
Ted, if they want to do a recount on the 96 election, I'm still available to serve. Haven't done that line before with you, have I?
Senator, if you had, it couldn't have been more apt than at this particular moment. But, gentlemen, it seems to me that we are at a juncture where the title question of tonight's broadcast, Is It Soup Yet?, loses its metaphoric nature and becomes, if anything, all too literal. I know I have some vivid memories of Campbell's cream of mushroom soup, especially at this post-election pre-holiday season.
Well, Ted, you know, cream of mushroom soup, since you bring it up, is about the only thing in this country the liberals haven't succeeded in destroying yet. Although, if Al Gore does somehow become president, it wouldn't surprise me if we end up having to go down to some government office to get our ration of cream of mushroom soup. But look, it's a meal in itself, and if it isn't at least as good as a Cuban cigar, I'd like to know what is.
Well, you know, the Senate dining room has a famous bean soup, but when I was the majority leader, I'd always sneak in a can of cream of mushroom soup in my briefcase just to have the chefs heat it up for me. It was damn good.
Reverend Jackson.
Ted, soup is good food. That's a fact. It takes a village to make a meal this satisfying. Let there be cream of mushroom light for those of us who are already chunky. But above all, keep soup alive. You know, there's no soup like good old chicken noodle soup, the Campbell chicken noodle soup. It's almost as if some Brooklyn Jews snuck into the plant there. But getting back, Ted, to the battle over the election results, I gotta say, you look up refusal to quit in a dictionary. You see a picture of Al Gore.
Exactly how would you look that up in the dictionary, Larry?
Ted, more to the point, a refusal to quit when all is lost and you're hurting the country by your stubbornness, that's not heroism. It's pathology. It's a deeply disturbing pathology.
Ted, 10,000 not counted. Many uncounted thousands turned away. Fighting for those voices, millions, to give them a voice, that is the highest form of public service. For Al Gore, the presidency would be a step down at this point.
Hell, I'd take it.
Gentlemen, it has become a cliché to observe that it is a cliché to say that after this process, whoever wins the presidency would in fact be the loser. Al Gore this week said that the winner would be the winner. Is the nature of winning itself under greater scrutiny now, or are we all losers?
Ted, if I can do the heavy lifting on this one.
Yes.
You know, Al Gore has been a loser since the day he allied himself with the corrupt Clinton machine. He lost Tennessee. He lost Arkansas. It wouldn't surprise me if even Tipper didn't vote for him. But Al Gore's status as America's loser is news only to the feminazis and environmental wackos who think that whatever comes out of Dan Rather's mouth is more trustworthy than what comes out of the rest of his body.
Larry, lighten the mood for us a little bit at this point, if you might.
Hey, has there ever been a better soup than Campbell's tomato soup? And can anybody stand in the way of Meg Ryan come Oscar time?
But, Ted, I want to go on record saying that tomato soup got me through my presidential campaign, such as it was. Liddy's got some recipes where she used it as sauce, and sometimes in her old Red Cross days, they'd use tomato soup just half diluted with water, you know, in training sessions to simulate the blood.
Reverend Jackson, we're facing a situation now that's almost intractable. Whichever candidate wins the disputed presidency, there will be dark mutterings and suspicions casting a cloud over his claim of legitimacy.
Well,
is there any way that soup itself can help to heal that rift, if it might?
Ted, I know you don't help a man up by putting him down. A race is too close to call is too close to call off. Maybe Vice President Gore, in proposing a meeting with Governor Bush, maybe he should have specified meeting over some beef barley soup and crackers. I know that that's a soup that crosses all boundaries. It's a soup that builds bridges, not walls. And I know that Governor Bush is a big fan of crackers.
And a veiled racial reference is as good a way as any of wrapping up this discussion. Gentlemen, I thank you all for shedding some light on the subject and some heat on the soup. That's our report for this evening. From all of us at ABC News, powered by Disney, I'm Ted Koppel. Good night.
This has been a special edition of Nightline. For a transcript of this broadcast, take very good notes. More people get their news from ABC than get their money from it.
Tree is the crying in the moon where a heart is lying. When you get the blues in the night, my own. But there is one thing that I know. A woman's a true face. Worry something will lead you to Santa Blue.
Survivor. After you've lived under Big Brother's gaze, there's still one ultimate challenge left. The reality show that's all reality is Hostage.
Welcome to the Fiji Parliament building. It will be your home for the next 3 months, and I am your host.
On an island in the Pacific, a rebel leader takes 30 people hostage. The government collapses. Foreign countries protest. But there's no rescue and no relief. Just plenty of food.
You don't know the meaning of work. You should clean up that bathroom before we all get sick.
How do you know? You are no doctor.
And every week, you can call 1-900-HOSTAGE and vote on who should never be allowed to leave.
I am tired of your whining.
Whining? You are the king of whining. Stop it.
Fame and fortune? Perhaps. But in the meantime, reality has a new last name. Hostage. Mondays, beginning as soon as we can get the first one edited. On CBS. This fall, we're keeping it real.
So, you know, the writers saved us from all of that, ladies and gentlemen. A final note this week on the subject of our digital future. It does not include time capsules. Apparently, time capsules disdain digital storage. Instead of laser discs, software, and computer chips, documents from the late 20th century have been printed on acid-free paper and sealed in steel boxes in the New York Times capsule located at the American Museum of Natural History. Forget movies and music, too. Whoever opens this window into today's culture will see books, magazines, a checkbook register, and a 1040 tax form. Says Stephen Mim, the project manager for the time capsule, digital formats, by and large, are not as permanent. Most storage media, CDs, discs, hard drives, deteriorate very quickly in the course of decades. CDs deteriorate quickly in the course of decades. Why didn't they tell us? Virtually indestructible, weren't they speaking? Wasn't that supposed to be the... I was told that that was the thing. We went with technologies that are able to bridge that technology gap. The other problem, he said, is how do you read it? The problem with digital archiving is that you have platform obsolescence. How many CDs did you buy? Oh, and one more note. Copyright limitations prevented the magazine from including any pop songs on the solid nickel album in the time capsule. Instead, the publication cobbled together an album of Sounds of New York.
Hey, get out of my way!
Oh, there's a contrary opinion. Paul Conway, coordinator of special projects and head of the preservation department at the Yale University Library, says, time capsules are all about faith. There's a much better likelihood that paper will be retrievable, but that shouldn't prevent us from telling generations hence that this is what we had hoped. We should have put digital in, he says. Put a digital TV in there while you're at it. An LP of this show, Bob? Yeah, we can cut one. All right, so we'll be storing this one analogically, ladies and gentlemen, because that will kick in the head this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the Armed Forces Network, on shortwave at WBCQ The Planet at 7.415 megahertz, and on your computer whenever you want it at www.kcrw.com. Soon migrating back over to www.harryshearer.com, but visa problems are slowing the migration. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, it would be just like being able to retrieve digital media in 10 years if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty. Thank you very much. Email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Once again, my thanks to the ineffable Mr. Bob Dunn here in the French Quarter for making this broadcast possible. Have a globally unwarmed summer, Bob. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world. Around the world, ladies and gentlemen. Think of it as the home of the homeless. From New Orleans.